105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.
Hello and welcome to the very first podcast from the Roy Basnett Show. Each week, we will be bringing you some classic moments from our award-winning programme on City Talk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. Don't forget, if you want to hear the show live, along with our latest guests and discussions, you can join me weekdays between 2 and 6am on City Talk across the North West and North Wales on 105.9 FM or DAB Digital Radio. Or you can listen online at citytalk.fm. In this week's podcast, we're going to hear from one of my guests who's been a bit of a lad in his time. Let's hear again the time when I caught up with Mr. Howard Marks.
City Talk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.
Now, the person that I've got in the studio at the moment, if you were to look at his educational credentials, would have been the last person you would have expected to be falling short of the law. But unfortunately, that is what happened. And I'm pleased to say that I'm joined in the studio this morning by Howard Marks. Good morning, Howard.
Morning, Roy. How are you?
I'm very good. How's life treating you these days?
Very well these days.
Right. So I looked at your kind of when you went into education, you were at Oxford, you were at the University of London, all this kind of stuff, and you would naturally assume that the profession that you would have ended up doing would have been, I don't know, maybe something like a lawyer or something that would be a professional person's kind of ways. So what kind of took you from the potential of being that into the area of crime that you went into?
Well, two things really. My first degree was in nuclear physics, and I never really had any interest in it. I just happened to be good at it, you know. I could pass the exams in it, but I didn't really sort of take apart bombs in my spare time or anything.
Right.
So I was qualified in a subject that I didn't have any interest in, and I started to smoke marijuana at the same time.
Well, it's a student thing.
It's part and parcel
of that particular form of part of life, really.
Yeah, I mean, certainly during the 60s, I mean, smoking dope was almost a privilege of educated middle classes, in a sense.
Right.
It wasn't really a working class drug as much as it is now. So it was seen almost as a sort of a fairly normal exploratory activity. I loved it. You know, the first joint I smoked, I sort of absolutely loved it and did what I thought was a fairly rational kind of reaction. Smoked another one and kept on doing it, and wanted to try different types of dope and more dope, and ended up, I suppose, buying more dope than I could sell, than I could smoke.
Right.
And usually if you buy more dope than you can smoke, you end up being a dealer.
Right.
So that's what happened to me, really. I just became a dealer as a result of my love for marijuana, my enjoyment of the state of smoking it, and doing a subject that I wasn't really interested in, or being qualified in a subject that I wasn't really interested in. I mean, I think everyone's relieved I'm not a nuclear physicist.
So in terms of so you got there, you got into it, you're smoking it, and your surplus, if you like, you kind of sold that on.
Yes.
So where did the step up come, and then you started moving into to bigger arenas, if you like?
Well, it was very, very gradual, Roy. I mean, I first smoked when I was 19, right? Which is actually quite old, really, isn't it, to start smoking marijuana. But that's when I first smoked it. And I became a significant dealer, I suppose, sort of moving sort of hundreds of pounds or kilos of hash a week by the time I was 24, 20. So it was like very, very gradual progression over five years. There was no sort of big jump at all. The big jump in my criminal activity, I suppose, rather than just the scale of dealing I was doing, was when I went from being a dealer to a smuggler. Now, if you become a big dealer, obviously one tends to meet smugglers because they're looking for big dealers. And I found smuggling very, very interesting. The dealing I found pretty much the same as any shopkeeper would find shopkeeping, I think. I mean, just, you know, you do it and you make some money. But smuggling I found very, very interesting indeed, because it entails sort of travelling around to different countries, has been exposed to different cultures in, you know, very, very different parts of the world. So I found the byproducts of smuggling completely satisfying my intellectual, geographical, historical curiosities, if you like, and, of course, supplying a hell of a lot more money. I mean, throughout this, money was very, very important. It's not as though it was an idealistic hippie, just I wanted to make a lot of money too.
Right. I see. So that was it. So you moved into it. Was there ever any kind of fear, thinking I'm doing something that's a bit naughty. I mean, I'm an educated kind of person. I'm realising what I'm doing wrong here. Was there ever any feeling of, God, I'm going to get myself in trouble here?
Not while I was still a student. I mean, I suppose I had the illusion of being slightly protected by the sort of ivory tower that the government has paid me to live in.
Right.
And because everyone else was doing it, I mean, I just did it at a slightly greater scale, perhaps, than anyone else. But I wasn't sort of out on a limb as being the only person who smoked and dealt small amounts of dope in Oxford.
Right.
So I felt somehow or other that there was that, as I say, protection by the ivory tower. And also, we all felt then in the 60s that it would just be a matter of time before cannabis would be legalised, and therefore it's just a question of making hay while the sun shone, and that it wouldn't be shining for too long. You know, we just do what we could before it became legalised and normalised. But it still hasn't been legalised. We were wrong.
Decriminalised to a certain degree, but certainly not legalised.
No.
So when did you first have your first encounter with the police then?
That happened during my third year at Oxford, when they just came round and busted the house. We were living in digs at the time, a few of us. They searched the house from top to bottom and found a roach and a sugar cube, which one of the guys who shared the house with me had stolen from a junior common room to sort of put in his tea or something. You know. So they thought they'd, you know, stumbled across an acid bit and a sort of major sort of dope smoking. But they just dropped all. Well, they didn't even charge.
Right.
That was it. But that was my first encounter with the law, which almost sort of reaffirmed my beliefs, really, that it didn't really matter.
Right, so it kind of lulled you into a false sense of security.
In a sense,
yeah. So in terms of, like, you'd gone into the smuggling and you were visiting countries and that, and then you're obviously bringing them through customs.
Yeah.
What about at that point? Do you still have that kind of the same mindset of, well, it's got to be legalised eventually, what's the point in me worrying about smuggling a thing through customs?
Well, that carried on for a while, certainly, but of course became less and less valid, as it was obvious that it wasn't going to be legalised tomorrow.
Right.
When I first started piling dope into cars and driving them across borders, say from Amsterdam, you know, from Holland to here, I would be nervous. There would be that adrenaline hit. There would be that tremendous fear that there are several years might be spent in prison if that customs officer doesn't just wave me through. But it was all worth it because of the almost religious flash I got after getting through. The payoff, the adrenaline kicks in. You're worried as hell. But the upside of it was well worth all.
And typically, who were you supplying your wares to at the time?
Well, these are the people I'd almost leapfrogged, really, if you like, on my path to sort of becoming a smuggler. They'd be people who I used to buy dope off.
Right.
On a wholesaling level, and now I was supplying them at a wholesale level. So it wasn't a sort of different set of friends that I had to meet.
Yeah.
It was the same people that, as I say, had leapfrogged over in my ascent to become a smuggler.
Right. So from the smuggling then, so obviously this went on for some time. And how long did it go when you were smuggling at this stage? How long did you go before the authorities became aware of your activities, as it were?
Then it gets complicated. About 1972, anyway. I mean, I started in the late 60s. By the time I came to 1972, 73, certain of the authorities were aware that I was smuggling, including the British Secret Service,
right?
Who decided to recruit me at that point, which I thought was wonderful. Yeah.
For what purpose?
Mainly to infiltrate the IRA, because they'd worked out that I was smuggling marijuana with the IRA, using the IRA drugs, gun smuggling routes, which I was, you know. I mean, that's exactly what I was doing. So they recruited me with that in mind, and went through the usual training things, you know, and supplied them with a few safe houses and letter drops and stuff like that in Britain. And in those days, MI6 didn't officially exist, you know, only in movies, only in James Bond movies, basically. And then they asked me to infiltrate the IRA and give information on a guy who said he was an IRA member whom I was smuggling with. I refused to do it, and they sacked me, basically. But that's when I came to the attention of the authorities, and then I was arrested in 1973, smuggling hash in pop group equipment from Holland to the States.
Right. I see. So That must have been.
I tried to make it short and simple, but it's hard.
Yeah, no, no, it's certainly fascinating stuff. I mean, I would imagine that if you did, I'm not suggesting anything here, but if you didn't cooperate with an organisation such as, you know, the Secret Services and what have you, that would put you in a very precarious position, would it not?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they never wanted, they never sort of press ganged people. I mean, they only wanted people who were sort of devoted to protecting national security. And I don't think they would ever put pressure on anyone, because that wouldn't work out in the end. The guy would be just jumping over to the other side as soon as he could. Because I went to Oxford, because I was recruited by someone who was one of my best friends at Oxford, I passed all the tests really that they thought were relevant at that point, and they'd assumed that I was against the IRA and would be only too happy to sort of drop information on them. I mean, this is long before this sort of blowing up sort of Tower of London or anything like this. This was in the days when, I mean, in 69, Harold Wilson, the Labour Prime Minister, sent in the army to protect the Catholic minority. So it was almost part of the regular 1960s left-wing agenda, if you like, to support the Catholic minority.
I see.
So it wasn't as if I, you know, early days I became a terrorist. You know, that would be a very wrong way of looking at it.
Did you find that you learned anything from your experience of being trained by MI6?
Yes, yeah. I mean, you learn how to lie. Which I found very handy in various trials afterwards. And you learn how sort of certain part of the world works. You also learn loyalty, you know. I mean, it tests your loyalty to friends, your loyalty to causes, your loyalty to nations. You have to think about all these things to find out which side you stand on. So, yes, I mean, certainly no shortage of learning.
So when you came out,
I didn't learn how to sort of, like, you know, shoot complicated weaponry and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was the hippie side of crime.
Right, I got it. So in terms of you'd learned some lessons there. You didn't want to play ball with the authorities, so I would assume that you went back and resumed your former career.
That's right. Yes, I mean, I never actually let my former career go.
Okay,
I always thought it would be. Well, I mean, instead of having a license to kill, I almost looked at it as a license to deal, you know, to sort of, because I had one foot in with the security services, I felt, again, you know, somewhat invulnerable to being caught.
So at that point, did you feel as though you could up your game a bit?
Perhaps? Yes, yeah.
And how did you do that?
Well, I was on the run. I'd been arrested in 1973. Granted bail on the condition that I wouldn't mention anything about the security services, and then I skipped bail. And I found being on the run, being a fugitive, probably the state that gave me most of my lessons. I mean, it was from that state I learned just about everything I've learned. And I did up it, yeah, and became more adventurous, because I had nothing to lose, really, because I'd lost everything. I was on the run.
Right.
So I was much more desperate, adventurous, and courageous, looking courageous, at least, than I'd ever been before.
So you're talking about assumed identities? And...
Yeah, oh, yeah, like, I mean, about almost 50 different passports and stuff like that. And dealing, and sending dope to Kennedy Airport, New York, and, you know, using the mafia to import it. I mean, it sort of got that high.
The mafia. I mean, how do you initially make contact with the mafia then?
By rising high enough up in any business you're in, really. I mean, if you go to the top of any business, you will come across the mob. You know, they're not confined to crime at all. I mean, they're everywhere. Not in any sinister sense. They were, I mean, at the top of any business worth anything, there would be someone with mafia connections, for sure. You know, as I went up the sort of ladder of hash business, I came across Gambino family in New York.
Gambinos?
Yeah, well, because they ran Queens, if you like, and because Kennedy Airport was in Queens, you know, the borough of New York, then they tended to be in charge of all airport stuff.
Right.
And I found them very, very easy to deal with. I mean, obviously, I never stole anything from them or cheated them or anything like that. And if you don't, they're extremely easy to deal with. You know? They turn up on time, they don't steal anything, and they're true to their word.
But surely there must have been some nerves. I mean, it's one thing to have the authorities on your back. I would have thought it's even more terrifying to be, you know, in contact with the mafia.
It's not at all, as long as, you know, as long as you're doing good business with them. And if you aren't doing good business...
You had a good relationship.
Very, very good relationship with them indeed. I mean, there's absolutely no problem.
And how did that function then? In terms of the smuggling into Kennedy Airport, how did that take place?
It would be sent from places like Pakistan, Thailand, Nepal, as air freight, usually in an igloo, you know, the thing that's the same shape as a cross-section of a plane, but like a pallet. It would be air freighted to New York. The mafia would simply remove it because they'd be running the freight operations within the airport.
So they could bypass the security quite easily.
Yeah, very easily, yeah.
Yeah.
They would keep their cut, if you like, which was
25%.
They would keep
What did you make out of it?
I don't
percentage-wise.
Know. God knows. I mean, it was always not an individual making a percentage, but a group, you know, as much as I could, really, I suppose would be the quick answer.
Yeah.
Not as much as 25%. Probably about 10 to 15%, something like
that. But it was still a handsome profit.
It was still a lot of money.
And it was your narcotic, if you like, was always marijuana?
Yeah, always
You didn't want to deal in anything else?
No, I wasn't really tempted to even. I mean, I couldn't even satisfy the demand for marijuana. You know,
right.
I mean, people have often asked me, you know, well, surely cocaine or heroin would have been more profitable, you know, because it's smaller. Well, you know, it's not really the money per unit volume that one uses to judge one's financial success. It's money per unit time, isn't it?
Right.
You know, so I could move a lot more marijuana worth of money than I could anything else. Plus, I was very, very convinced that marijuana was completely harmless, and cocaine and heroin, I wasn't that convinced it was, so I didn't want to sort of risk any sort of karmic problems. You know?
Yeah.
So I felt absolutely safe and could sleep completely okay just doing marijuana. I mean, I think if I'd had my time over, I'd have probably done a lot.
You know? So in terms of when this happened, what was the period of time between establishing contact with the mafia and being caught, if you like?
Well, I was caught before I established contact with the mafia. I established contact with the mafia while I was on the run.
Yeah.
As a result of the prowess, I suppose, I'd achieved in moving dope before then. Then I met the mafia while I was on the run, continued being on the run for about 6 years, and then I got caught bringing in 15 tons of Colombian marijuana into Scotland. But I got acquitted of that. Which was handy. Which I took almost as sort of God's way of saying carry on smuggling.
So obviously that happened, and then you were in the States, you were doing the business with the Cosa Nostra, if you like.
Yeah.
And then when did you realise that the, well, obviously the authorities probably would have been alerted anyway through the connections that they would have
been.
Well,
yeah, by this time I was known to the authorities on a daily basis, you know.
Right.
Like, where is he now? Oh, he's probably doing, yes, he must be doing that, he must be doing this. So, you know, I suppose my poster would be in most policemen's.
Okay.
Police stations with darts being thrown at it.
Right.
At that stage.
And when did they catch up with you?
They caught me next to the 15 tons of Colombian in 1980. Right. I was 2 years on remand then, which obviously was a bit of a hiccup in my progress. Got acquitted and then went back at it. And that lasted probably about another 6 years. And then I got caught properly and extradited from Spain to America and sentenced to 25 years in prison.
25 years?
Mm. But I got out after 7, so a bit of a result.
What was the prison that you were sentenced to?
The prison that I did most of my time in is the only federal prison in the US with a death row, which is where they lethally injected Timothy McVeigh, for example.
All right.
I mean, state penitentiaries, most of them have death rows, but there's only one federal penitentiary, and that's at Terre Haute, just outside Chicago.
And what was that experience like?
Interesting.
I've
actually probably a lot, I mean, I've also sort of spent time, you know, when they move you around in county jails and sort of less, you know, not maximum security prisons, other types. And I think maximum security prisons are better, really, because you meet a better caliber of person there. They're not going to be too petty with the rules because there's nothing else they can do. I mean, most people are going to be spending the rest of their lives there, you know. They're not going to be told to tuck their shirt in. You know?
Yeah, right.
So,
but must have because of this kind of feeling of invincibility up until that point. I mean, it must have come as a shock to the system to be
put that vulnerable and that exposed. Yes, it was. Yeah. I mean, I felt I had to put myself in the hands of God, really, or in the hands of the gods. Yeah, I mean. Luckily, I was foreign, right? So I wasn't American, so I didn't have to have allegiance to any particular gang.
And there were gangs in there.
There were gangs in there. Yeah. I mean, in fact, most of the state prisons, if they had senior gang members who were uncontrollable or against the order in the prison, would be sent to Terre Haute, the prison that I was in. So you had a lot of Bloods, lots of Crips, you had the Vice Lords, you had the sort of Blackstone Rangers, you had just about every gang you ever heard of in any film. Mm. Some members would be there. And of course there were gang fights, but as I say, being British, you know, it might as well have been from Mars, you know.
Nobody bothered with
it. No one wondered whether it was a Blood or a Crip. You know? So that was good. Plus, I'm fairly articulate. I could read and write better than a lot of them there. So I became a jailer's lawyer and would end up, I did sort of manage to overturn some convictions and get people's sentences reduced and write letters to the girlfriends, you know. I mean, and taught quite a lot of them to read. So I was a useful asset to people. I'm not a macho threat to people generally anyway. So survival was nothing like as hard as you might think, you know.
Right.
The farm. I mean, the grief was nothing like the grief of my parents' death or something like that, you know. I mean, there are far worse things that can happen to you other than losing at a game you decided to play, which is all that happened. So I don't look at it as a terrible ordeal looking back at all.
Was it sufficient, the spell you spent in prison, for you to think, I ain't going to do this game when I come out?
Oh, no, I'd do it now if I thought I could get away with it.
Really?
Yeah. Well, there's no reform or sort of remorse there at all. I mean, there's a lack of ability and the profile is too high to sort of rationally entertain doing it, you know.
Yeah.
But there's no...
But is this the reason that you say that? Is this because of your belief that cannabis is something that should be legalised?
It's partly that, right? Yeah, sure. That the law is stupid and therefore, you know, that the only way a stupid law is going to be changed is if enough people break it, really. You know? So that's part of it. But also, I suppose, a fondness and a respect for various criminal codes that, I've encountered and embraced during my period, both in and out of prison over the last 20, 30 years.
And what about your political standpoint? Because you stood, was it 1997?
Yeah, I stood in the 1997 general election in four different constituencies, actually, at the same time.
Right.
But that wasn't a sort of bid for political power at all. I mean, that was just using the election to draw attention to the issue, really. And I think from that point of view, it worked, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it did get a bit of publicity. People began thinking about it who hadn't thought about it before.
Hmm.
But it wasn't me trying to be a politician.
Right.
You know, I mean, there was obviously no chance of my winning anyway. So, and, you know, if a miracle had happened and I'd won, I would have just, you know, what would I have done? Skinned up in the Houses of Parliament.
Right. Would have been interesting. I mean, the thing is, though, I mean, obviously, you know more about the subject than me, and I must confess that I have never actually taken anything like what you do.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you campaign, obviously you would like to see this particular drug decriminalised and, you know, obviously legalised.
Yeah.
Does it not concern you that there are reports that suggest that it can affect people's mental well-being? Do you?
Oh yes,
not accept that.
Yeah, no, I accept that completely. I accept that, you know, for some people it's probably the last thing they should take. You know, most inappropriate relaxing drug that they could take. I think for lots of people they take it when circumstances that are inappropriate to take it. And I don't promote marijuana. I mean, I really don't care whether people take drugs or not. It's not my criteria of judging a friend. I really don't care. What I do care about is that they should be imprisoned for deciding to have taken it. I think that's all I'm against.
Right.
That's all I'm campaigning for. It's not the promotion of drugs. I really don't care, despite taking them every day.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not promoting.
Right. So what about little anecdotes from your time? Is there any particular story that sticks in your mind, amusing or something from your career?
Well, one has just come to mind now, I don't know. I explained earlier that I had lots of false passports and everything.
Yeah.
One of the first false passports I had was an Irish one, given to me by my so-called IRA contact. And it was in the name of Peter Hughes. And this was the first time I'd ever used a false passport. So a little bit nervous, obviously, yeah. And everything. You know, was it? Is it just a Mickey Mouse one? Is it really? Did it come from the office? Is it going to work? You know? So I flew from Dublin to Brussels, and nervously now in the sort of immigration queue, you know, with my new virgin green sort of right. Irish passport. About to, he takes one look at my passport, looks at me and says, "Ah, Howard." Right. You know, what? You just saw the name Hughes. Howard Hughes was in the news all at right. the time. And I just sort of made that sort of like connection audibly, yeah. You know. But I thought, God, rumbled right away. It's impossible.
That's fantastic. Well, Howard, thanks very much for speaking to us this morning.
No, very much, my pleasure.
It's certainly been a pleasure. And I wish you well for the future.
Thanks very much indeed.
And that's this week's podcast from The Roy Basner Show on City Talk 105.9. Don't forget, you can join me live on the radio each weekday morning between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. on City Talk across the northwest and North Wales on 105.9 FM or DAB Digital Radio. And of course, you can listen live online at citytalk.fm. That's it for now. Catch you next week.
City Talk 105.9, the best of Roy Basnett.